Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, with Roughly Speaking, episode 328 for Tuesday, November 28th, 2017. We bring you a couple of interesting conversations today about Baltimore and city life. One with Mike Heslin, the market manager here for Lyft, about the company's vision for growth in ride sharing in and around Baltimore. The other with one of the hundreds of millennials who have moved into downtown Baltimore in the last few years. While the city's overall population dropped a bit in the last census, after a period in which it had stabilized, the downtown census tract continued to see growth, and the demand for apartments in the old business canyons remains strong. William King resides at 10 Light Street, the old and mighty Maryland National Bank building, that Art Deco edifice at Light and Baltimore Streets converted into apartments. King and some friends last year formed the City Center Residents Association, and King is now its president. The old business district has started to take on the trappings of a residential neighborhood, and the association wants to build on the quality of life in downtown Baltimore. I had a conversation with King recently at a sidewalk cafe just a few steps from his front door. I guess we should say we're on Light Street, right in front of 10 Light, looking across at one light, right?
Amazing. That's exactly right.
This is going to be the new M&T Bank office in Baltimore, and some other things.
This is going to be your flashy, shiny new office tower, the newest in Baltimore when it opens next year.
So if you hear some construction noise in the background, that's what's going on across Light Street from us.
And those are great sounds to hear down here, too. Everybody says that we're seeing more development, fresh development, in downtown Baltimore than we've seen in a long time, between 414 Light Street, the One Light Street project here. So it's a little annoying in the morning when you live right here, but it's great sounds to hear.
And there's more coming online. So listen, you've only been here a short time. I've been here for 40 years. And, you know, we've been struggling with all kinds of social problems in Baltimore, crime problem that has peaks and valleys and too many peaks like we're going through now. But then you see all these cranes, you see all this construction. We're in the 401 census tract, which has been the fastest growing census tract, I think, in the state of Maryland, at least in Baltimore City, for a good while now.
The 401 census tract is Pratt Street at the Inner Harbor, all the way up to Mulberry Street, up Mount Vernon area, and from I-83 President Street to the east, all the way over to Packer Street. And it's also known as the old downtown, the old commercial business district. And what's so interesting about this is for 200 plus years, it's been the commercial hub of Baltimore City. And through the process, through the ages, it fell into kind of a more depressed state over the last 25, 30 years. But just recently, in the last 10 or 15 years, it's been reborn as a residential community. And some of the best examples of this process are the conversion projects, like 10 Light Street, the old Maryland National Bank building, just opened about 2 years ago. Big office complex, was kind of falling apart, was bought and completely turned into approximately 450 apartments. And this is happening all over here, 26 South Calvert, 2 Hopkins, the Lenore, the Muncie building. There are a dozen or so of these places, old office buildings, finding a new life in a changing Baltimore as apartments. And so all of a sudden, like you said, we have the 401 census tract exploding. Even as Baltimore itself continues to lose population, the 401 census tract, I think from 2000 to 2010, went from 1,700 in population up to 4,000 people living here. And I think we're going to see in 2020 a similar kind of jump up to roughly 6,000 now living down here.
So that would suggest, based on the last census, the city is losing population in other quarters and not in this census tract.
And the question is, what has caused that incredible influx of people to move here? And what can we do to keep that moving and hopefully spread that around to the city?
Okay, what explains it? And before we go into that, though, a little bit, there's issues that I raise, especially about crime. Now, you moved here how long ago?
So I moved here in November of 2015.
Okay, I mean, that's after the riot, the Freddie Gray Day riot in April of 2015, and then we had this surge in violence, and Baltimore gets this, you know, a rebranding of its reputation, even worse than its reputation before. So I wonder, you know, as a person who lived here all this time, what appealed to you about moving here?
The center of the city, as we call it, we're trying to rebrand it as City Center, is unique from other residential communities in that the geography is key. You are...
I mean, for you personally, what brought you here?
I grew up in Towson, went away to school in Philly, went to law school in D.C. I got a job here at the federal courthouse, and like a lot of the millennials, I wanted to walk to work.
You have a very pleasant walk to work.
I do.
It brings you close to the Inner Harbor on Pratt Street to the courthouse.
It was a beautiful two-block walk. And so I worked there the last 2 years, just started a new job across town. I work at Venable now, law firm down here. And that's five blocks the other direction, so I'm still walking. And that's been a huge draw for me, the walkability of this neighborhood. You can't find that anywhere else in Baltimore.
Do you own a car?
I do not own a car.
So the issues that I raise, this is the reality we face. It's sort of like two cities in one. You know, you have the Baltimore that's growing, that has cranes in the sky and growing census tract, and then you have poverty and crime still in certain parts of the town. But that didn't stop you from moving here.
It doesn't stop me because the benefits certainly outweigh, you know, the very real drawbacks you just talked about. And it's funny, I just had a conversation 2 days ago with a small business owner in downtown here, directly talking about the crime issue. And just for people who aren't familiar with City Center, don't work here, don't live here, the crux of the problem we have right now is in the evening from roughly 6 p.m. to midnight, you'll have a lot of juvenile offenders. It's quote-unquote low-level crime. Homicide rate is not very high here compared to the rest of the city. But we have petty theft. We have small break-ins at storefronts and that kind of thing. So it's a real threat. But there's a tremendous amount of pressure from the business community down here because this is still a business hub. And increasingly from the residents now to attack this problem. And we have more resources here than other parts of the city do, in part because we're still this downtown hub. And we're seeing a tremendous coalition of effort, people coming together, Downtown Partnership of Baltimore, the developers right here of 10 Light and the One Light Street Project are all putting a lot of pressure. And this is happening right now, this week, next month, to get private security here, off-duty police officers, pressuring the city to make this more of a priority. And that's why this is such a promising location, because we have so many stakeholders invested in solving the issue.
Do you ever feel, aside from the personal convenience of living downtown and walking to work and enjoying all the amenities there are downtown, that you're investing a piece of yourself in the future of the city? I guess it's civic mindedness I'm talking about. Do you ever have those thoughts?
I do. So the City Center Residents Association is a brand new community association just for this area. And it's something I spearheaded when I first moved here back in November 2015. And it grew out of what you're talking about. Because the kind of person who wants to move here, they're obviously attracted to the benefits, the location, walking to work, the Inner Harbor right here, the amenities. But it's also a certain kind of person who's interested in the changes that are happening here. Because it's a very unconventional place to live in Baltimore. If you grew up in Towson, Catonsville, anywhere around here, you've heard of Federal Hill, Fells Point, Canton, Mount Vernon. And when it's time to, you know, rent or buy a house and you're drawn to downtown, you pick those because they're kind of the traditional hotspots. So the kind of person who moves here is attracted to the uniqueness of this regeneration, this conversion that's going on in this space. And so we capitalized on that. It's, you know, architects, people in the medical profession, whole very diverse group of people. But they all took an interest in the role they could individually play in moving this neighborhood forward. And so that's how the CCRA, City Center Residents Association, came to be. Because even though most people here are renters, maybe they haven't wanted to buy a house yet, can't afford it yet, doesn't mean they're not interested in building a community and being part of a traditional homeowners association, community association.
How would you describe the other people who've been involved with your organization, the people you've met in your own building, and just in social life downtown?
It's one of the coolest things about this neighborhood, and you mentioned some of Baltimore's longstanding social problems. The center of the city is the fastest growing census tract. It's also the most diverse. And what that means is you have diversity of age here, racial diversity, diversity of career path, and it makes this an area unlike what Baltimore's seen before, and it's very promising because of that. And as a result, we have this unique diversity of talents that comes with that, diversity of experiences. And so we're able to brainstorm and try to tackle some of the problems here with a sort of a more unique viewpoint than you find in other places. And one of the biggest aspects to that, and this is a lot of people drive this home, is because this is a less conventional place to live in the city, people from Baltimore more often than not don't choose to live here. But we get a lot of people from out of town who are first time in Baltimore. And when you have that, you have people who aren't so much stuck in the mindset of what Baltimore has been. You have people who've lived in New York, lived in London, lived in Boston, lived in D.C., and they move here with fresh eyes, and they can see what this this downtown hub could become, and that has been a major benefit.
I don't have it handy, but there's a great statistic on that. The number of new residents in this census tract, even maybe in this building, who are from out of town, that came from Kirby Fowler of the Downtown Partnership at their annual meeting, and I don't have it handy, but folks, at some point in this podcast, you'll hear what it is. It's an impressive number.
It's incredibly impressive. And you mentioned Kirby Fowler and the Downtown Partnership. As the residents of this neighborhood have mobilized to try to get more involved with improving the neighborhood, problem solving, the Downtown Partnership has been a great partner. And they've been working on turning this old commercial district residential for 20-some years. And in many ways, they see the fact that residents now live here in great numbers and are sort of starting on a self-governance sort of path as sort of the fulfillment of what they've been trying to do all along. So they've been great partners. The business community is great partners. And I think there's a lot of great potential here.
When I first came to Baltimore, and people have said this over the years, it's a city of neighborhoods. It's something like between 200 and 300 distinct neighborhoods, and they have neighborhood associations. You don't think of downtown as a neighborhood. But as this part of downtown has become more residential over the last 10 or 15 years, and you know, office space has moved over toward Harbor East, a lot of it, you don't tend to think of people who live in the canyons as having a neighborhood or a neighborhood association, but it sounds like that's what you want to establish.
And you hit on the greatest challenge we face here, and it's a issue of perception. So, like you said, Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods, but Baltimore is also very insular. It's less transient than Northern Virginia, D.C. area, Montgomery County. And so the challenge we face is the people who are going to live here, these the young millennials who we always talk about who are moving downtown, most of them are from the ring of suburbs around Baltimore. And like I was saying earlier, they all think of these traditional neighborhoods we've always heard of as quote-unquote neighborhoods. But what we're trying to communicate to people is you can have the same experience, if not a better experience, in the center of downtown. And I think the problem is when people think of the area around the courthouse, Royal Farms Arena, Charles Center, for most young people in their 20s, it's where their parents and grandparents went to work in the 80s. And that's what this area means to them. And as they've driven down here, you know, in their childhood, that's what it's been.
To go to Ringling Brothers.
That's right. That's exactly right. As a pass-through to the aquarium or exactly.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing is incredible investment. And 10 Light, 2 Hopkins is a brand-new apartment just came online. We're seeing this incredible influx. And some of the value add we're trying to add as a neighborhood association is programming. And Downtown Partnership has done some great programming. We're also stepping into this now.
What do you mean by that?
We have a network of all the people who are living here now through Facebook, Instagram, our email list. And what we'll do is about once a month, once every other month, we'll have a showcase social event just to pull people out of the buildings and walking around the streets and checking things out. Because there's so many benefits to this neighborhood. A lot of people don't know they're here, even if you live here. And so what we've done is, for example, we went to Chesapeake Shakespeare Theater. We've been to the Lord Baltimore Hotels, LB Sky Bar, Rooftop Bar, which is a great spot. I'll put a plug in for them. And we'll have a neighborhood social event And we'll get all these, the numbers we have here, the population, coming down and actually interacting. And that's where community and neighborhood formation happens.
I remember years ago I read a book called The Great Good Place by a sociologist named Ray Oldenburg. And in that, he talked about how people didn't have enough casual places to go. It wasn't work, wasn't home. It was a bar room, a coffee shop, a place where everybody knows your name, where, you know, people become familiar to you. But in that book, he talked about the isolation of suburban teenagers. And he was on the cusp of the millennial generation. He talked about how, you know, that generation is not going to want to live isolated in suburbs with no sidewalks, which is where a lot of their parents raised them, right? It's where their parents raised them. Do you think that's true? Do you hear that from anybody that they say, you know, I like cities. I want the city life. I want to be urbane and urban.
I think it's a national trend, and you're right. People talk about this a lot with respect to real estate and where we're going with that. I think it's true to, you know, in short, answer your question.
Was it true for you?
It's true for me. For me and my peers, there's something about city life, the ability to walk places, the interconnectedness, the sort of the social energy you get when you are, and it's all about proximity, being close to a grocery store, being close to a bar, close to a restaurant, and close to your friends. And it's funny, we joke in 10 Light Street here that it's like a dorm. And it's a lot of us came out of college and either lived somewhere for a couple of years or came straight from college into here. And we wanted that same kind of camaraderie, you know, staying up late with your friends and working on a project or going out together and coming back and having it be a safe, you know, communal area to hang out. And that's what people are attracted to, and that's what we're finding in a downtown urban environment. One of the challenges we're going to see as this generation that loves that starts to get a little bit older is, like, city center here, we have an incredible number of apartments and new apartments coming online. And it'll be interesting to watch as people my age in their 20s and 30s maybe want to buy something. There are fewer options for owning down here. And it'll be interesting to see if maybe some of these buildings become condos where you can buy a unit. Because there are very few right now. I think it's 414 Water Street and the Brecco condominiums about four blocks north here are about the only two complexes where you can own a unit in city center here. It's mostly apartments. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with that, whether people will go back to the suburbs for the benefits of home ownership, or if we're going to see some pressure to get some more ownership opportunities down here in the center of the city. For so many people who live here now, they have some sort of history here, and that's a great benefit of Baltimore versus vis-a-vis Montgomery County, D.C. suburbs. And for me personally, one of the coolest things about living here is my dad, my grandfather, my grandmother, my mom, and, you know, aunts and uncles on both sides of the family all have some story to tell down here. And they either worked at Charles Center. My grandfather worked his whole career at the old B&O building right here. And now it's a bar and a hotel upstairs and offices, which is great. But there's something so cool about this millennial generation now, in so many cases, walking the same path that people before them walked in this new life that downtown is taking on. The brick and mortar is the same here, but it's all about finding a new productive use for the space that's so cool.
Yeah, I keep waiting for that big circle to close. You know, Baltimore lost so much population to the suburbs, and there was a racial divide. You know, we're 50 years removed in 2018, 50 years removed from the big riots that hit in 1968. Then you had all that white flight that followed it, and some black flight. It'd be nice to see this come back and have a city that's diverse as it is, multiple classes of people, and just a generally a healthier city. That's what we keep hoping for and waiting for.
I think the city center is going to be a big part of that closing of the hole you just mentioned. And I'll tell you why. So much of the flashy new development we've seen in Baltimore in the last 10, 15 years or so has been all around the rim of the harbor. And you can talk about what that means as far as kind of the equity and the social progress, if we're making any, with Baltimore. But the center of the city isn't escaping Baltimore's problems. Redeveloping city center is the bridge between these luxury harbor developments and the rest of the city that we so often forget about. And in that sense, I think it's the key to what's possible going forward, and that's why it's so excited to be here.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill King is president of the City Center Residents Association. That statistic I mentioned from Kirby Fowler of the Downtown Partnership is this. 80% of tenants in 10 Light Street, where Bill lives, are from outside Maryland. And Kirby Fowler says the owner of the apartments at 520 Park Avenue reported a similar trend there. Bill King says the City Center Residents Association was recently granted 501c3 nonprofit status by the IRS. If you're interested in hearing more about downtown living and the association, you can find information and links in the notes with this podcast. A short break on Roughly Speaking, then we'll hear from Mike Heslin, Baltimore market manager for Lyft, about the company's vision for transportation in the city.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
Now to Mike Heslin and Lyft in Baltimore. A competitor of Uber, Lyft has enjoyed some impressive growth in its ride-sharing service in the last year. Its customers include people like Bill King, who live in the city and don't own a car. I spoke with Mike Heslin recently about Lyft's vision for the future, and I learned, as you will, that it includes a rental program for drivers who don't own a car, and in at least one new South Baltimore development, designated pickup spots. Lyft sees continued growth as lifestyles change, and as more people who choose not to own a car pay for access when they need one. I'm not usually in rush hour traffic, but I happen to be in rush hour traffic in Baltimore, 5 o'clock, Jones Falls Expressway. It was amazing. It was a revelation to me. And I've been around for a long time. I just don't have the Jones Falls Expressway 5 o'clock experience very much. And I was stunned at how slow it was, how many cars were there, how long it took me to get to a place that usually only took 10, 15 minutes. So this is part of what you're all about, right? Lyft and Uber are both interested in all this traffic we have, right? And doing something about it.
Well, we're trying to do something
about it.
we're trying to create a better travel experience. You know, we ultimately hope that riding is the new driving, and that at times when before you would have had to be behind the wheel, sitting in traffic, not doing any of the million other things you need to do with your time,
right,
that you can now have a safe, convenient, affordable experience where you are the passenger instead of the driver.
But I'm not sharing the car with anybody. It's still a car on the road. How does that diminish the number of cars on the road?
Great question. And ultimately, our vision here is we want to end personal car ownership. We want to create a system that is about access instead of ownership. So you no longer need to own a vehicle in order to have access to convenient, affordable transportation on demand whenever you want it. And anytime you leave your house, you have a host of options that you can choose from, and you can choose the one that's best for you. You know, right now, the fleet of personal vehicles in the United States is in use for about 4% of the time. 96% of the time, that's about 23 hours out of every day, the average personally owned vehicle is sitting idle. This is a big problem for asset utilization. It's a big problem for the environment. It's a big problem for the way our cities are built and the way we use space. And ultimately, we are out to end personal vehicle ownership.
This is really interesting. You know, I've never thought about that for a minute. My car is sitting out. Today I drove here to the Sun, and it's sitting out in the parking lot for 8 or 9 hours not being used. You're saying I shouldn't even have to own a car.
That's right.
Okay. So I use, what are my options? Public transportation, a bus, right?
So the, you know, ultimately there is this, this history, this trajectory we've been on, that is really centered on personally owned vehicles. And it used to be that the only way that you could have the exact travel experience you want at any given time
is to
have that car sitting out in your garage or out in front of your house. The future we're working toward is that it's about access. So you can go out of your house, and if you are lucky enough to live in the right place, you can take a water taxi, or you can take a bus, or you can take a Lyft, or you can take a light rail. whatever it may be. And we can get to a place where the lifestyle you want to live, that level of convenience, that level of access, is actually greater when you're not tied to a vehicle you own.
Okay, I understand how this fits into Lyft's business model.
Sure.
That's on one level. But it also sounds like you're at an advocacy level on this too, that you're talking about the way cities are designed, the way we live.
Yeah, you know, we have this history in a nation of transportation revolutions. And there was one in the 19th century when we had a railroad system put in place. We had a canal system put in place. And all of a sudden, parts of the country that had not really been accessible except at great peril, all of a sudden were. Mm-hmm. And were brought into the mainstream of society. Then come the 20th century, we had the second big revolution, and that, of course, was the personal automobile. And, you know, you had the Jack Kerouac on the road and
a real... See the USA and a Chevrolet.
Exactly.
That was Dinah Shore. That was before your time, kid.
I'm familiar.
but
so you had the second transportation revolution of the automobile, and this happened to occur simultaneous with a great deal of urban development in our country. So you have these cities now, Baltimore included, that are really built for cars instead of people. And what we are out to do is change behavior and change preferences and change the definition of what the best transportation options mean so that we can get to a place where our cities are built around people instead of cars.
Do the business plan for me, or the vision for the future, both tied together. Conflate them. A vision for the future and Lyft.
Yeah, so
tell me what you're thinking. What does that look like?
The question is, what does it mean for Baltimore to be built for people instead of cars?
Yeah.
And I think there are three big components. One is the future will be multimodal. So we need access to a number of different forms of transportation, which, by the way, we are quite blessed with in this city. We have a city-owned bike share system. We have a light rail system that's poised for expansion. We have dedicated bus lanes already in our downtown area. We have the water taxi that's going through a transformation and expansion right now. The multimodal future here is quite bright. And the challenge, and this is not just a challenge for us, but this is a challenge for a number of different stakeholders, is how do we make those options easier and more attractive and more convenient, and by the way, more affordable than owning a car, which costs on average about $9,000 a year on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And so our challenge is, number one, to provide the best, most convenient, safest service we can with the best experience, and to do that at an affordable price point. And then to think about the different kinds of partnerships that we need to get in place in order to work collaboratively toward this future. So that could be partnerships with the public sector. It could be partnerships with major employers. It could be partnerships with other modes of transportation. And all of these things are very much on the table, real estate owners and developers.
Real estate is very important, I would think, in terms of where people live, the choices they have about where they live, the affordability of where they live. Because where you live and where you work, those are the two main points in the day, where you start your day, where you go during the day, where you end the day. If you could do all of that without a car, that would be pretty cool. So you need more people to actually live in places where near where they work. You need people to actually move into the city.
Well, I think that's actually something you're seeing anyway in the world of development, is many more of these mixed-use developments where people can live and work in the same place or nearby.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be what's desired. Marriott Corporation was out in Interstate 270 and 695 someplace, like at the Maryland-Virginia line, somewhere like that. And they chose to move to downtown Bethesda. Their new mm-hmm. headquarters is because they wanted to be near public transportation. Their employees were asking for that.
Yeah, and I think you can't underestimate the role that public transportation needs to and will continue to play in this multimodal future, you know, for longer trips, to create a true network in the city and the metro area. Such an important piece.
Autonomous cars, this is an interesting subject to me because I'm still trying to understand what that might look like in the future. The idea that you don't have to own a car, you can call for a car, maybe share a ride with a couple other people.
Yeah, autonomous vehicles are something that we are really, really excited about. And I won't go into too much detail on it, but it is certainly going to be a transformative element.
Is that something Lyft is looking at, autonomous cars? I guess everybody's looking at that.
Lyft has a number of partnerships set up in the autonomous vehicle space. Waymo, the part of Alphabet, the same family of companies as Google, Jaguar, Land Rover, Ford, GM, a number of really exciting partnerships, as well as dedicated autonomous companies like Newtonomy.
Just on a personal level, I mean, do you think that's something that's going to happen, the public's going to accept?
Yeah, so I think there's a big question around what the transition exactly looks like. But I think the public will use transportation options that give them three things when it comes down to it. One is reliability. The second is affordability. And the third is the experience.
This is the part that is tricky for me, to imagine people choosing not to own a car. I interviewed a young guy just the other day, lives downtown, has no interest in owning a car. He walks to work, he lives downtown, he thinks the whole thing is cool. But people like their independence. You know, they like driving to the mountains for the weekend or driving to the shore or, oh, quick, I want to go shopping and there's no quick bus there, right? So I like having this car, even if it sits in my driveway 4 days, 5 days out of the week. It seems like that's a tough one. That's a tougher sell.
Well, I think the question is, what do people like, right? They like having that flexibility and that freedom. Do they like paying their car insurance bill every month for a car that's sitting idle 96% of the time? Do they like needing to go and find parking every time they go from place to place? So people really like the flexibility and the freedom that has historically come with owning a car. The question for us and, by the way, for other modes of transportation, is how do we offer that same level of freedom and access in this multimodal future? And that's something that we are working on, and that's something that it's an answer that has many parts.
It's probably an easier sell with the younger generation, right? The next, your generation. How old are you, Mike?
I'm 30, 31.
Yeah, so you're a millennial, aren't you? Doesn't that put you in the millennials?
You could call me that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's an easier sell with your crowd.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, because we all grew up, I'm 63, we all grew up with the cars, you know, one car, and then I was two and three, four cars. I mean, that's crazy. I think that's crazy. I actually lived through a period of carpooling when people took carpooling seriously, at least tried it. That seems to be a thing of the past, but maybe it'll come back with autonomous vehicles.
Well, and it's already coming back with car sharing, right, and ride sharing, where—
Is it? I don't do that. Is that happening?
We have a product called Lyft Line. It's not available in Baltimore right now. But if you go down to D.C., it is available there. And it's a multi-user ride share. It's a truly shared ride where you will get picked up at your house or at your place of work or wherever you are. And then on the way to where you're going, you might pick up someone else who's going the same direction. Or there might already be someone in the car when you get picked up. And in doing that, we're actually able to, number one, improve the efficiency of the fleet overall, improve that occupancy rate of our fleet of vehicles, and bring the price point down for the people taking the rides.
How is Lyft doing in Baltimore these days?
Lyft has had a phenomenal growth story in Baltimore. We launched the app here back in 2013. And come 2016, so we grew kind of steady for a few years there. Come 2016, we really hit a tipping point. And we grew ridership from the start of 2016 to the end, 8x. That led to a number of new opportunities.
The growth in volume or the growth in number of drivers? Or
in number of rides.
Rides given.
Right. Yep. Huh. And so that meant that we could do things like hire a local team, which I personally am really excited about. That meant that we could launch our rental program called Express Drive that we operate in partnership with General Motors and Hertz, where we can give access to vehicles to people who might not otherwise be able to afford it or have the credit score to go out and get a traditional
lease.
What
does that model look like? If I need a car for a couple hours, I can rent one?
It's actually on a weekly basis.
A weekly basis.
Yeah, so you would come in and rent the vehicle, and you then pay by the week, but it's designed for people giving rides on the Lyft platform. So if you give a certain number of rides in that week, you get all or part of your rental fee actually reimbursed to you.
Oh, that's interesting. And so you become a Lyft driver for a week?
You become a Lyft driver, and it's usually on a longer-term basis, not just 1 week. But for people who want to be Lyft drivers and either don't have their own car or don't want to put the mileage on their own car required to be a driver, And especially if you are planning to, you know, work a good number of hours out of the week on Lyft, so that you are able to hit these rewards, mm-hmm. it's a really good solution. You know, maintenance is included, insurance is included. So it has been a really powerful solution for a lot of people.
If you don't mind me asking, how is it working out with cabs, taxis in Baltimore? I'm amazed that people call cabs and taxis when Lyft and the other services available, when Lyft and Uber are available. And I still see taxi cabs at the airport. I see them at the train station. I see them going up and down the main streets of the city. I just wonder, what's your sense of how all that's working out?
We're really focused on our mission here.
Yeah.
And what we're doing, and we want to transform transportation in the city, and we want to transform how the city works. Lyft is fundamentally.
Well, maybe I should ask somebody who's got a cab company how it's affecting them. But it doesn't seem to me. I don't understand how cabs can continue under the. I mean, are there regulations that protect cabs in Baltimore?
You know
about that, don't you?
Fundamentally, Lyft is a very different service than taxis.
Oh, I know. I understand.
All of our drivers are individual contractors. They work when they want to, and they're using their own vehicles, by and large, outside of this express.
I understand, but I'm a customer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why. I guess if maybe people don't trust the service or don't have the app, they don't call Lyft or Uber. They go back to a cab because that's what they know, right? I don't know why you would continue to do that if the other service is available to you and it's less expensive.
Yeah, so I'm really focused on what okay. we're trying to accomplish.
So you're the wrong guy to ask about the cab business.
Sorry.
So it's all right.
So we're really excited about some of the partnerships we've been able to build. We talk about, I've talked about kind of the multimodal future. I think that's a big component of the future vision. Another big component is that our fleet of vehicles out on the road will be utilized much more efficiently. You know, so Express Drive, for example.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
A first step in that direction.
Yeah. Lyft Line sounds interesting to me in terms of efficiency. Is that potentially coming to Baltimore?
So it's something that we are always considering, cities to expand to with Line. And I think, you know, if that were to come to Baltimore, it would be one more step toward this improved fleet efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
As was Express Drive.
And Express Drive is available now in Baltimore.
Express Drive is available now for those who want to drive for Lyft but don't have a car of their own. You know, that's another major component of this future of transportation. I think the third component is a lot of the space right now in the city that is devoted to cars, and in many cases cars sitting idle, will go back to being devoted to people. And so you can think about some of the large parking lots that are in prime real estate downtown. You can think about buildings that are built with multiple floors internally dedicated to parking garages and cars just sitting there. This is prime real estate that can have a lot of really, really good uses.
Tell me about it. Right out the back window here is the Jones Falls Expressway, and beyond that, the Fallsway. And near that, Edison Parking, vast open lots for parking. And there was a plan put forth to knock down the Jones Falls Expressway, starting somewhere around Penn Station, turning it into a grand boulevard, or as the French say, un grand boulevard, with wide sidewalks, wide streets, trees, bike lanes, children walking up and down the street, parents, boulevardiers sauntering up and down the streets, fewer cars. Wouldn't that be beautiful?
Your listeners can't see, but you're painting a beautiful picture.
Yeah,
in the studio and
imagine
right
more row houses over there where those parking lots are. It's all just look. You know, when you go outside, go take a trip over there and look at that. There's great potential there, and there's a canal underneath it. You could open up the Jones Falls and actually see the river again someday. That's my dream, and fewer cars.
Well, I think that proposal is still on the table.
I wish someone would pursue it. I see old photographs from the Baltimore Sun Library here of streets before there were a lot of cars. And it's kind of amazing to see those photographs. Wide open streets, wide sidewalks, and there's something missing. It's, you know, all the cars parked one after another, head to toe.
Well, and I think if you have things like dedicated bus lanes, and you have things like wider pedestrian lanes, and you have things like shared vehicle use, you can actually increase the capacity of roadways like that that are currently dedicated to personally owned vehicles in making them more useful to people.
I hope you're right, Mike, because I'm not going up the Jones Falls Expressway at 5 o'clock again. Not if I can avoid it.
One partnership that we're really excited about is with McHenry Row. And that's a community mixed-use development in South Baltimore.
Yeah.
Was built about 5 years ago before ride-sharing was really a part of daily life in the city. And we had a conversation with 28 Walker, the development company that built that. And they have this situation where they have one-way ingress and egress, and they have some parking garages that are increasingly unused. And they have a good amount of parking spaces there, but not really a safe and convenient way to get a rideshare vehicle. So we worked with them to identify three locations in the development that are really safe and convenient spots that could be used for ride sharing. And so they are in the process now of marking those off, creating dedicated signage that says lift pickups and drop-offs here. And then we actually mirror that infrastructure in the Lyft app so that if you open up the app in that community, you're directed to one of these three spots, both the driver and the passenger, and it's just a really convenient, easy experience.
So you open your app and you see where those spots are to go.
So you open your app, you see where those spots are. By the way, they're in places like directly outside the entrance to the apartment or office building, so really conveniently located. Right. And it tells both the you as the passenger and the driver to go and just get picked up right there.
Hmm. So you're looking for other arrangements like that?
Yeah, so we are exploring a number of different partnerships, whether it be with other property developers and managers or with other modes of transportation or with public sector organizations or with major employers. We are very much in partnership building mode right now.
All right, Mike, good luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Mike Heslin is Baltimore Market Manager for Lyft. More information about the company's programs in the notes of this podcast. That's our show for now. I hope you enjoyed it. Comments welcome. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and sometimes Christina Tasek. This is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.